Die neueste Ausgabe von Skobel ist auch ein Experiment, denn das Gespräch, das nun folgt und auf das ich mich wirklich Wochen, im Grunde sogar schon Monate gefreut habe, musste ich auf Englisch führen und zwar aus einem guten Grund. Bislang waren ja alle Gesprächspartnerinnen auf diesem Kanal deutschsprachig und das soll auch in der Zukunft überwiegend so bleiben. Aber manchmal gab oder gibt es ja gute Gründe, mit jemandem zu sprechen, mit dem man das nur in Englisch oder irgendeiner anderen Sprache machen kann. Bislang habe ich mir das immer verkniffen. Der Zufall wollte es jetzt, dass ich mit dem Zen-Meister Henry Shukman, meinem Gast gleich, zunächst für einen anderen Podcast ein Gespräch geführt habe, für den Podcast Integrative Achtsamkeit, den Podcast für Achtsamkeit, Meditation und Psychotherapie. Warum? Henrys letztes Buch, das im Original Original Love heißt, ist inzwischen im Arbor Verlag auf Deutsch erschienen. Und das erklärt den Podcast, den Sie mir freundlicherweise überlassen haben. Persönlich kenne ich Henry Shukman seit 2012. Er ist Zen-Meister der Sambo-Kyodan-Schule, die vereinfacht gesagt zurückführt an die Wurzel der ursprünglichen Verbindung der beiden großen Zen-Schulen oder Zen-Richtungen, also Soto und Rinzai. Mit Henry verbindet mich eine längere persönliche Geschichte, weil ich nicht nur an einer Reihe von Sessions teilgenommen habe, die er geleitet hat, sondern über die Jahre hinweg auch ganze Stunden mit ihm im Dokusan beim Koan-Studium verbracht habe. Was das Englisch angeht, habt ihr die Möglichkeit, entweder das Original zu hören oder das Original mit einer Übersetzung von YouTube, die ihr dann als Untertitel einblenden könnt, oder ihr seht bzw. hört das Ganze mit KI-Synchronisation, dann natürlich nicht mit meiner und Henrys originaler Stimme. Kurz noch ein Wort zu Henry Shukman. Er ist also Zen-Meister, Achtsamkeits- und Meditationslehrer, das hat er unter anderem in einem Gefängnis mit Jugendlichen gemacht, spiritueller Leiter Emeritus des Mountain Cloud Zen Centers in New Mexico, das unter anderem deshalb in den USA ziemlich bekannt ist, weil es von einem der Pioniere des Zen im Westen gegründet wurde, von Philip Kaplow. Während der Corona-Pandemie begann Henry damit, die Meditations-App The Way aufzubauen. Und darüber hinaus ist Henry, der ursprünglich aus Oxford stammt, ein preisgekrönter Lyriker und ein umfassend gebildeter, wie ich finde, wundervoller Schriftsteller. Sein neuestes Buch stellt für mich so etwas wie einen ungewöhnlichen, aber logischen, naheliegenden nächsten Evolutionsschritt des Zen im Westen dar. Es hat den Titel Ursprüngliche Liebe, ist auf Deutsch im Arbor Verlag erschienen und darin versucht Henry das, was im Buddhismus als Erwachen bezeichnet wird, aus einem westlichen Rahmen heraus neu zu verstehen, am Rahmen, der über die Zen-Tradition hinausgeht. Worum es also in unserem Gespräch geht, ist über diesen Weg des Erwachens zu sprechen. Und ich hoffe sehr, dass euch das Gespräch interessiert und bin gespannt, wie euer Feedback mit dem Englisch ist.
Skobel. Philosophie, Wissenschaft und Leben im Gespräch.
Henry, so nice to see you again after a long time.
Yeah, likewise, Gert. It's a real joy to get time with you like this. Yeah.
And maybe I should, you know, tell people before we start that we know each other from Zen practice and koan training, for which I'm really, really grateful. I would like to start, for all those who do not know you, with some short questions about yourself. And then I propose that we just walk or maybe slightly run through the book so that everyone knows what's in the book, you know, the wide scope of the topics and a glimpse of what it is, for it's also a book of practice. And thirdly, I would like to go on, if we have time, from the book with a few questions that came up, as I think, quite naturally after reading the book. So now you're spiritual director emeritus at Mountain Cloud. What does emeritus actually mean in practice? What have you handed over and what have you kept?
You know, I've handed over pretty much everything to the incredible care of Valerie Forstmann Roshi and her partner, Scott Thornton, a sensei. So the two of them are really running the teaching side of Mountain Cloud. And it happened because, basically it happened because I had a head injury. I had an accident on my bike and I had a concussion and it had very long lasting effects. This was 6 years ago now. And I still have some lingering effects from it, actually. I can do almost everything I want to do, but just much less. And the particular effect that was really difficult for Zen teaching was that, I had optical trouble. And, that, as you'll know, Gert, from your own experience, there's a big part of Zen training is the one-on-one meetings between teacher and student. And, you do a lot of those if you're a teacher. You can have, many in a day. And I couldn't do them. And so I was not fit for purpose. I had to step back. And very blessedly, Valerie and Scott were ready to step in. So that was really, really fortunate. So, yeah, I'm largely in the background. I come now and then to give a talk, basically.
And then you started your app, which we might talk about later on. In your first book, Blade of Grass, and even in this one, you describe yourself as a 19-year-old self on the beach in Ecuador, and then the collapse in the bathtub in Oxford when you came back to, the place you grew up. Looking back now after decades of teaching, how would you describe the relationship between those two moments today, not as a cause and effect, but as they actually live in you now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, just for people who don't know, I mean, what Gert is referring to is when I was 19 on a beach in South America, I had a sudden awakening experience that just landed on me out of nowhere, where I discovered I was, the self I'd thought I was just had been a fabrication, and I was actually part of absolutely everything. I wasn't even part of it. I was one with everything. What I really was something that was the whole universe, but that wasn't my ordinary sense of self, And it was utterly blessed, I was filled with love and relief and a great sense of belonging and lots of compassion. My heart opened, and it was fantastic. And then 6 weeks later, I went home to Oxford, where I'd grown up, and had a kind of breakdown. I had a very, very difficult re-entry in which I really had to, for the first time, I think I was open enough to actually feel the complex developmental trauma that I'd grown up with, but for various factors, and which I don't need to go into now, but I was stripped of all my adaptive strategies because I was so open. Therefore, was overwhelmed with the actual trauma and pain of my childhood for the first time. In different circumstances, that would have been tremendously helpful, I now think. But I had no support, no resources, and very little sort of education in psychology and emotionality. I was emotionally illiterate. And it was very, very difficult. And I had a real despair for a few years. So those two things, the revelatory discovery of what we really are, because it was unmistakable what I'd found on that beach was the truth. It wasn't some strange altered state. It was actually the truth of things, and of course it was strange in that it was unfamiliar and not how I think most people, definitely myself included, normally lived, but it was real. I knew it was real. And then it was a marvelous discovery, and then back to this utterly, very, very difficult despair with a lot of shame as well came with it. And, so I feel that an open heart is open to both those. And that is my aspiration, is to live with an open, wide open heart that can, that can be with the difficulties and pains of life and the great losses and heartbreaks of life, and is also open to the boundlessness that is what we are as well.
Maybe it's important for us to know, because there's something like natural awakening, which you talk about in your new book, which is Ursprüngliche Liebe in German. And also because, it tells people that there was a long way you had to go. Now, taking the German title, my question doesn't really work, but taking the English title, which is Original Love, I think it works, because I think that's really a smart title. When I first heard about it, I thought, how smart is this? because a key concept in Christianity, which undeniably formed Western thinking and living, is original sin. So we live after the fall. We are already lost. We are bad. We have to be ashamed. We are corrupt and for all eternity. And there is no way out except, for the grace of God. And then you come with a book saying original love from the very beginning.
Yes, I know. Well, I think, theologians will, I'm sure, correct me, but my impression from the reading I've done is that this might be a bit of a fault line between Eastern and Western mm-hmm. religious thinking, that there's an idea in Eastern traditions that, no, we are originally blessed, and all whole and in a sense, perfect. But we've got a lot of dirt and contamination and poisons and things that sort of get in the way of us knowing that. Therefore, the spiritual path is one of a kind of cleansing to get back to an original sort of purity. This is very schematic, but largely. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the West, the idea is seems to be more, yeah, we're originally sort of damned, but we can be redeemed,
Maybe.
But by an outside power, maybe if we do all the right things, So to me, because of that experience I'd had when I was 19, I just could not buy that Western approach. And I'd been brought up the schools I went to, it was a thing in England, all schools, typically you had a hymn every morning and a prayer, but that was the extent of our home was atheist. And so I wasn't brought up really in the bosom of a religion. And, we actually might go to church once a year for Christmas, for a carol service, to sing carols. But it wasn't really part of my makeup, except insofar as it's in our culture, So it made sense to me, the Eastern view, that there really is something already here that is true and utterly soteriological. It saves us. We're already saved from the beginning in that terminology. We're already okay, but we've got a lot of things that get in the way of our being able to recognize it.
The funny thing is that one thing I learned with you doing koan training is how important love is. When you look at the Buddhist scriptures, and I talked with one of your teachers, John Gaynor, about that, there is almost no part of it where they talk about love, at least not in the way you talk about it. So that's odd too. You're promoting love in a way as an Eastern way, as you just explained, but it's not much in the scriptures. Yet it's there, of course, but it's not in the scriptures.
Yes. Well, I would maybe just push back a little bit on that, because there is a Theravada teaching of the Brahma Viharas, so-called, or the sublime abidings, or there's many different translations. But, four, let's say, wholesome states of mind and heart. And the first is loving kindness. The second is joy for others and their well-being. And the third is compassion. And then the fourth is equanimity, which all have some different flavors of love in them, but they're ones that you're supposed to cultivate. Whereas, you see what I mean? You're supposed to, in those traditions, you develop those. Whereas my view is no, that there's a love that's already here, and that we can discover it. So it's not so much a cultivation process. I think that's a great thing to do as well. But actually, there's also something innate and already here and intrinsic to experience that's loving.
It's our true nature, might say.
Exactly. In Zen, they talk about, in Mahayana Buddhism generally, original nature.
Nature.
And Zen talks about, have you seen your original face? Meaning, really, have you seen your original nature? So my little twist is also not only on the Judeo-Christian side, but also a little bit, I think, on the Mahayana Buddhist side. Yes. No, let's not call it original nature. That's too neutral. It's original love. It's something really, really good,
And what a great title, because there's a double twist in it. So I'm glad we talked about that. Now, the subtitle of your book is The Four Inns on the Path of Enlightenment, Awakening. So we should explain what the four inns are. And this is connected to a story you bring up, or really a text by supposedly Bodhidharma about the two-wheel ruts. So maybe we just run through the four inns briefly so that everyone knows what the red thread in your book is.
Okay. So I'll tell you what they are, and I'll just say a sentence on each. The first is mindfulness. The second is support, or we could add connection, support/connection. The third is absorption or flow or samadhi, you know, deep concentration. And the fourth is awakening. So I'm saying that, you know, essentially the kind of spiritual development we can nurture through meditation practice has four dimensions primarily. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, of course you could slice and dice this in different ways. This is one, I think, reasonably comprehensive, but not absolute or fixed, you know, way of looking at it. But I think it holds up broadly speaking. And it's particularly helpful at the moment, I believe, because, you know, meditation practice has spread insanely in the globalized West. And there's a lot of confusion about it. Like, you know, people will use terms in very contradictory ways compared to how others mm-hmm. use them. So I wanted to just, let's get clear on this, because these mm-hmm. four things are not all the same. They're all good, but they're not all exactly the same. So mindfulness, yeah, it's about becoming more aware of being here now, in a nutshell, a present moment awareness, knowing our present moment experience, meaning knowing now, being aware of now. So that's both external experience happening now, you know, what we're seeing, hearing, and sensing in the body, and sometimes there's smell and sometimes there's taste, and it's internal awareness as well. What am I feeling? What thoughts are arising? You know, mm-hmm. how am I doing? What's my general heart state, mind state, you know, mood and so on. So being aware of all of that, that's mindfulness, which is the bedrock really of all meditative development. Secondly, it's really great if we can get a little bit of a sort of sense of connectedness, support, and not being alone in this, because one of the hazards of the mindfulness movement of the last 20, 30 years is that it can seem like it's something I got to do on my own. You know, it's like doing my reps at the gym. I got to do my breath meditation, breath awareness, you know, and it's all down to me. But no, there's lots of ways that it's a practice of discovering connection and support. And it's also a practice that is greatly fertilized by support and by connection. And
When you study MBSR, so what Jon Kabat-Zinn was teaching, there is, however, this idea of a group. Of course, you do most of the work by yourself, but there's also a group in which you share your experience and are supported in a way. So there is even in mindfulness, there is a slight remembrance of what Sangha later on is.
Yes, I totally agree. It is there. At the same time, you can hear people talking about it all over social media as if it's just something you have to do on your own. And, you know, there's another dimension to this as well, which is sort of the human soul and the human soul's sense of connection to nature, to the landscape, to being part of something bigger. All of that is wonderful, and poetry enriches that. And, you know, working with our dreams can enrich that, and sort of shamanic practice, animistic practices, they all recognize, yeah, there's a deeper connectedness that we're part of, which is not the same as awakening, mm-hmm. you know, but it's a beautiful thing to get to know. So I think that needs to be called out as well. Thirdly, there's flow states that come on in meditation, which are traditionally called samadhi in Buddhism, meaning that the gear changes. It's a gear shift. You know, you're sitting there doing your meditation, and it's, you know, it's like it usually is, you know, maybe going better, going worse, according to your own judgment. But then suddenly there's, whoa, it's just different. There's an ease, a clarity, an effortlessness and a richness and less sense of self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it's just beautiful. You think, what did I do? How did this happen? And then you lose it, you know. but that kind of ease and flow in meditation, it's what is traditionally called samadhi, really, you know. And there are different flavors of it. There are different systems that explore it and look at it, and it that too deserves to be called out and named as a capacity that we have that meditation can open up, you know. And I think it's personally, I think it's very akin to flow states, you know. It's in meditation, so it's a little bit different, because typically flow states are viewed as something that comes on when you're engaged with some kind of challenging activity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, well, you could say that of meditation, of course, but you could also argue, well, and meditation is not exactly an outward activity. It's not like, you know, working on repairing your bike or mm-hmm. playing the violin or going for a ride or, you know, run or something. It's more inward than that. But I think there's something similar that happens that's mm-hmm. akin to flow states.
And psychologically, it's similar, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so beautiful. It's fantastic that we have that capacity, and the more we meditate, the more it'll come on, you know. And also, the more we meditate, the more it might come on in other activities in our life. In other words, mm-hmm. meditation can make us more flow prone, you know, which is a good thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's all great, but that's still not awakening. So you see what I mean? I was trying to express that there's lots of great things that happen in meditation. That if nothing else happened than any one of these three things, it's 100 times over worth it, you know. And there's also the fourth in, which is awakening. And there's a particular meaning of the word awakening, you know, that is used in the deep meditation traditions. And it means basically to for the ordinary sense of self to drop away enough that we discover something that encompasses all, mm-hmm. and that we're not just the particular, you know, mm-hmm. hopeful, troubled, you know, beautiful, rather not so beautiful self that we've taken ourselves to be all along, that has been some kind of an invention that somehow we created and chose to believe in. We see that.
Yeah. So that's basically what Dogen, I think, is saying, you know, dropping off body and mind. So you sort of lose yourself, but you find something else.
Exactly. You find a larger self, we might say, you know, that is all inclusive. And so there's a couple of reasons why I wanted to map this out. The first is that there are some traditions that it's awakening or bust. The only thing we're after is awakening, you know. Yeah. Well, and that, you know, and I mean, I understand why one might feel that way, because it is so remarkable to make this discovery. But at the same time, we're missing out on all this good stuff in the first three ins, if that's mm-hmm. our focus. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there's traditions that don't really call out awakening clearly.
Yeah.
You know, I did an MBSR course where people were taught, any time you notice you've been thinking, that's awakening. You know? And, you know, in the Zen world, we'd say, well, no, that's practice.
Yes.
That's not awakening. Yeah. So I want to get the terminology out there mm-hmm. to whatever small extent I can, so we all know what we're talking about. You know, the phenomena are clear.
So all these ins are different, and I think you sorted that out brilliantly in your book. But they're also connected. And it took a while for me to understand in which way they are connected. And there, you know, the trace of the two wheels on the way is very helpful, because the first three make one trace of the wheel. Yes. The other one is accompanying that process all the time, and we might not even notice.
That's exactly right. This is a brilliant metaphor from early Buddhism. There are other metaphors too, but this one says it's like, from early Chinese Buddhism,
yeah.
5th, 6th century. It says practice is like a cart track. So it has these two wheel tracks. You know, if you imagine a cart track disappearing over the hills, you know, it's two wheel tracks, obviously, one for each wheel. One of them, like you said, is this path with the first three ins. It's a path of development. It's a programmatic, path of cultivation and development. That's there.
You go further and further with the car, you know, sort of driving.
Exactly. But the fourth in is the other wheel track. And actually, that one is really different in that when we drop into it, when we fall away and we discover it, we find it's always been here. And it is indiscriminate. Like the other wheel track, the one of cultivation, you sort of get better at it. You actually can develop these capacities. But with awakening, you can't. You can, it's already fulfilled. Whenever you find it, it's like it's been here all along. There was nothing to develop, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the great relief of it, in a sense. But, you know, it's with us all along, but we may not recognize it. But meanwhile, we're developing anyway when we're working with the other mm-hmm. wheel track. Yeah.
And in the third stage, as you said, our membrane between us as isolated from the world and, you know, the reality out there, this membrane becomes less and less. And yes. That's not awakening, yes, but it's sort of on the way to awakening.
Yes, I think it's like the fabric gets threadbare.
Exactly.
You know, that's it's it. A little bit, maybe a little light starts to come through. But there's a decisive shift. It's maybe just one molecule jumps mm-hmm. from one side to the other. It's a tiny thing, but it's enough that suddenly we just release our sense of self and world as we'd known it. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're suddenly sort of bathed in a sense of eternity or something, you know, because there's no time and there's no space, no distance, you know. And I love the way that Zen has always been aware of this. Like there's just one little example. There's a little dialogue. It's not really a koan. I don't think it's in a koan collection, but it's like a koan where a monk asked Joshu, this great teacher, you know, how far is it from here to Chang'an? Chang'an is the capital city. And Joshu says, it's 300 miles. And then the monk asks, how far is it from Chang'an to here? And Joshu says, no distance. So that's exactly the cart track illustrated, you know?
Right. And what maybe people who don't know the book already should know is that you not just describe the various or the four ins in their distinct way, but you also provide some practice and some practical help to get deeper into each section, so to speak. So that's important. When you describe these four ins, is that the perspective of Zen in a new language or in a new way, or are you describing something different?
That's a great question. You know, there are different categorizations of practice in Zen history. Like even very early on with a master called Wei Nung, who was back in the, he lived in the 7th to 8th centuries. I think he died in 713. So he was mostly 7th century master. So very early Chinese Chan master. He said there's four kinds of practice. And one of them would correspond to mindfulness, mm-hmm. you know. One of them would correspond to the third in that I have, the getting into absorption mm-hmm. or samadhi. And one of them definitely corresponds to awakening. And his second one is a little bit different, but I can't exactly remember what it is now. Mm-hmm. And then there's another categorization of five kinds of practice that developed, I think, in the 18th century. these four inns aren't an exact match across the board, but I feel they're an update. Yeah, update that's relevant for today, yeah. You know, and that largely correspond, you know.
And they're always, I feel that even though they're distinct, there are some transitions between them. So it's not like a real step, and then you have to look for the other step. Sometimes it moves smoothly into another dimension.
I totally agree. I mean, there's many a time I've been sort of in the realm of mindfulness, mm-hmm. and suddenly there's some unexpected sense of support that just can arrive from who knows where. You know, might be very material form that I happen to have a conversation that just resets something for me in a beautiful way, in an unexpected way, you know, or it could be less material, but I don't know from where, but something from deep in the unconscious just surfaces and resets things. And, you know, who knows exactly how and why, where there's the great, I mean, I like to think that second zone opens us to the collective unconscious, you know, the archetypal realm, or the realm of unseen support, you know. Yeah.
Which Buddhism somehow uses all the time, but not in the way we phrase it, or not in the same kind of terminology we use.
Yeah, well, I guess in Buddhism we talk about bodhisattvas, mm-hmm. and it's true. There's kind of hidden, I was going to say, sort of religiosity or something, because this territory mm-hmm. is a little more religious, you know. I would say mm-hmm. that, you know, I hope this isn't sacrilegious for some, but I would say that most people, their relationship with Jesus would be on this level. It would be a kind of archetypal level where there's a figure or power, an entity or something that you feel in a palpable way, but they're not mm-hmm. material, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's a large part of human spirituality that I think if you look from a Jungian perspective, it's fairly easy to sort of to frame it in a way that's not too supernatural, you know, that there is there's some kind of collective unconscious that, you know, is our private unconscious, but it opens onto our shared unconscious, and who knows what's in there. Lots of stuff can come and help and also challenge us, you know. So I totally agree that I would think of these as sort of propensities or something, or as emphases. They're different mm-hmm. emphases in our spiritual development, but they're distinct enough in their center zones, you know, that they really need to be called mm-hmm. out.
Yeah. Yeah, it helped me to clarify, you know, different types of practice. And I think what you're saying is, and that's something I think a lot of people experience when they meditate for quite a while, is that when you sit down in order to meditate, depending on what day it is and what's happening with you, it might make sense to start with breathing instead of koan training, or vice versa, or, you know, start with hearing the sounds around you. So the entries you take every day when you sit, right, there's a pluralistic kind of approach to it.
Yes, exactly. So we have a multifaceted approach system, you know, because we're multifaceted beings, you know. Yeah. So I mean, another thing I would say here is that, yeah, I think it's, which comes exactly out of what you've just said, really, is that it's healthy to be developing in all these areas. You know, if we're too focused on one only, we might be missing really important stuff. And I sometimes wonder whether, you know, cases of this sort of terrible scandals that have happened in practice communities at times, you know, maybe they were all in on one of the inns and not looking enough at, they may have been particularly all in on the fourth one, for example.
Possible.
And not looking enough at the human development side of mindfulness, you know.
Now you might think, well, great, we end up with awakening, we close the book, but that's not the case, because Henry comes and says, well, remember, there are the 10 ox herding pictures. And when you close your way or the book now, you're closing it at picture number four. Yes. And that's much too early because there's a lot more coming. And that lot more coming is really to enculturate the experience you probably or possibly have made. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. I mean, it's a blessed thing to be on a never-ending path, to be on a path you will never fully accomplish. It's such a blessing. It's such a beautiful thing. I mean, for one thing, it rips out perfectionism.
Yeah, for some people, that's annoying because they think you should be perfect at the end.
Yes, yes, yes. But alas, not here. You know, I mean, I can speak personally about this a little bit. That, you know, I think I was very lucky, you know, in some sense in my practice and challenged in others. You know, and but one on the lucky side, I had that strange spontaneous awakening when I was 19. And then I happened to have a deeper kind of experience along the way when I was deep in my Zen training, where really mm-hmm. everything fell away. And I was actually changed by it. You know, some sense of self that up till that point would typically reconstitute. Whenever it was blown away, it would reconstitute. It actually didn't. And mm-hmm. I'd never imagined that would ever happen for me because I'd been quite a troubled person, mm-hmm. you know, for many factors behind that. But actually, it was gone and it didn't come back. And for many years, it just stayed open. Something stayed open. And that what happened in that moment, the moment of that experience, remained. It sort of was like everything was here as it was, but that experience was also here. And
that's
I could feel...
In Zen terminology, that's the difference you make in your book between Kensho, which is sort of a glimpse or maybe a flash, a profound one, you know, just like the one you had at the early in your life. And then there's Daigo, which is something lasting, a permanent kind of openness, and you can go into it anytime you want.
Yes, I mean, that's how, I mean, one has to tread carefully here because there's lots of different ways these things are interpreted and understood. But certainly something happened to me, I can say, that I never expected that had mm-hmm. some lasting effect. But then I had, you know, COVID came and I had a head injury, as I mentioned earlier. Yeah. And I had a very, very difficult situation in life with a dearly beloved, close person who got into a terrible, very difficult situation, and it was heartbreaking. And it was a new state for me that I was, mm-hmm. I couldn't really use my brain mm-hmm. in the way mm-hmm. I normally had. And the only thing I could do was feel my broken heart. And I started to just live from my heart. And that was around the time that I actually wrote the first draft of this book, Original Love. It was right before the head injury, actually, the first draft. And then the head injury happened. And then this very difficult situation happened for a beloved person in my life. And I just lived in my heart. And what it meant was that I didn't, and I couldn't any longer teach the way I had.
Yes.
Because of the head injury. So I wanted to share just from my heart. And I happened to have just written this draft of a book. Mm-hmm. So I started using that format to share about these essentially four paths, which we've just been talking about. But another aspect of them is that they're four ways of opening up love.
From the outside, you know, being in Germany, hearing about your accident and that something changed and, you know, I didn't know what. It was very unclear whether you were just following a new kind of Zen path, you know, as a lot of Zen masters have done before, because they open up, you know, new schools, new temples, monasteries, and so forth. Or if you said, no, that's it, break, you have to do something completely different. And at that time, of course, I wasn't sure. From the outside, yes. I didn't know.
I think I would have to acknowledge that I'm doing something different from what I had previously been doing.
Yes.
I believe it's very, very much informed by Zen. And I would call it a sort of, I don't know, it's a little more introductory, maybe. It's not that, the practice previously was kind of a high level practice, you know. That kind of training that you and I were doing is pretty sort of high level.
Also, it was very much in terms of the Chinese or Japanese traditions. And I even noticed that, you know, when I studied Zen with you, that you stripped off all the years before, you stripped off more and more of that cultural trait, which was in Japanese Zen as it is in Chinese Zen. But it was not explicitly Western too. You just open up to a more simpler approach. So I wasn't sure if what you were doing now was just in continuation of stripping off, you know, these stories and traditions and rituals more and more.
Yeah, it might well be. I mean, I think I was never that keen on liturgy and and ritual, you know. And, you know, and anyway, that Sambo Zen lineage, you know, nobody wears robes, you know, it's very rare anyway that anybody wears a robe. It's pretty bare of some of the formalities that Zen can have.
In comparison, yes.
Yes, exactly. And I think I feel the heart of it is the human heart and really the human heart. I'd always felt that, you know, when I remember a time when I was at Zen Mountain Monastery in New York State. I used to go there to do retreats way back. And I remember they were having a conversation once. It's very formal there. Everybody's in robes and, you know, it's quite liturgical and all of that. And you know, it's monastic largely, you know. Mm-hmm. They're having a conversation about sort of what's brought you here? Why are you practicing, you know? And as the conversation was going on with a group of us, with one of the monastics leading it, I knew my answer. It's about love. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, and I shared that, but, you know, whatever, the conversation was going whatever way it was. But I realized that I knew that that was what was really going on in this practice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't manifest. It's like I could sense it. And I knew it from that, because of that experience I'd had on the beach when I was 19, that the big aftermath of that experience, when I was sort of back being me, it was this sense of incredible love, that there was a great mind that held everything. And somehow this universe was somehow a sort of expression or even an act of love, that it existed at all or something. That was what really hit me. Whatever reasons, that's how it struck me. So I felt years later when, you know, put on the spot and asked, why are you practicing, each of you? What's calling you here? I knew that, I discovered that's why. It's because of love. And so that sort of stayed with me as a sort of recognition that that's what this is really all about. And if that's the case, what do we really need by way of cultural paraphernalia? Maybe we need some things, sure, but what do we really need? I'm curious about that. Mm-hmm. You know,
when you think about, you know, the history of various forms of meditation, there is also in Buddhism, there is some sort of evolution. Now, obviously, Zen or Buddhism changed from India to China, Japan, Korea, which is different again. So there is an evolution. And then it came into the West long time ago. It changed there. It was re-imported to Japan and actually revived Japanese Zen, which was already almost dead. Yes. So I thought maybe Henry is working on like the Western new form of Zen Buddhism, but I might be wrong. I just don't know.
Look, I think I'll be dead long before we'll find out, you know.
We're all dead before that, I guess.
You know, we just don't know. And I mean, I think that the way I've sort of categorized these areas of practice, I mean, it was six years ago that I first sort of expressed that. I've been actually thinking about it a year or two before, but I still haven't yet felt, oh, Henry, you really messed up there. I haven't felt that. I think there's still something to it, that it's approximately right and helpful for these times when we're so, yeah, you know, at least the great, fast, rapid, exponential spread of meditation is very new. You know, so I do think these aspects need to be called out and named, you know.
Well, the problem, of course, is, and you sort of mentioned that various forms of meditation or mindfulness were, you know, sort of became part of neoliberalism, part of our way of doing business, you know, of being successful, that sort of thing. You know, you have more energy, you have more of positive kind of thinking, that sort of thing. You know, yes. More emails per second. Of course, parallel to that, you have this development with various apps. You have an app yourself. And I was never much fond of that, but that probably has to do with your sort of guided meditation. That's not my thing. Because I just don't know. It's just not my thing. So I wonder how you think about that, because, you know, apps and sort of ready-made steps of meditation maybe increase the danger of being incorporated into this economic system.
Right. Yes. I think that's a fair point. I mean, I'll just tell you the background story to how I came to be part of that. It was a very particular set of circumstances. I'd written that book, and a publisher was going to be bringing it out in the US. And one of my Zen students, who I've occasionally met with, he's a guy in tech. You know, he's done a lot of different apps and had a lot of success, actually, and he knows that world backwards. And he says, we've just got to do some kind of Zen app, Henry. Let's do something. And I didn't really, you know, it was neither here nor there for me. But then I thought, well, I've written this book that maps out these territories of practice. I'm also teaching courses, which is something else online, which I never thought I'd do. You know, cut back to the beginning of 2020, I wouldn't have done any of these things. But the combination of the head injury plus COVID, I was teaching courses online.
Of course, you had to. And by the way, before even COVID, we had Doku-san via video. And that was great. I mean, there is no time, no space. So it was great.
Exactly. So I thought, it just dawned on me, oh my gosh, with an app, I could actually lead somebody through the experience I'm talking about with each of these terrains. And I've got different dimensions to each one. I've got a ton of curriculum to share. And this could be a tremendously helpful foundation for somebody's practice. If somebody went right through this app, and it's about a 3-year thing to go right through it, if you do one a day, it'll be a fantastic foundation, and they can go off and do whatever they want to do. But this will be a great foundation. Above all, because it's not just a library of content, which is what, you know, most meditation apps are. It's not. It's an actual guided experience through the four ins, you know, and you do it in a particular way on the app. You don't just do one, then the other, then the other. You go round and round, and it gets deeper and deeper with more and more stuff. So I felt everything's coming together for this to happen, you know, and I just agreed. And I felt that to be honest, this is a little bit woo-woo, you know, whatever, but I felt, you know, that with this open heart, I was just being guided, and I was accepting the guidance. And right now, in awareness of the caveats that you enumerated, and I do agree with you, but I think actually the potential good is greater, that this could be, You know, for many people, I mean, we get incredible feedback from people using it.
Yeah, it's very it's very good rated and positively rated.
People are finding it really helpful for establishing a meditation practice. And I feel that this is a training program. And
I mean, I would have been so happy when I had that when I was 16 or 17, for example, because there was nothing on the market when I was interested in that. So that's a tremendous help. And I think it's good to have a good app from a good teacher, which helps you and tries to, you know, helps you to understand these four ins. However, from when you are at a certain point, I feel that's just my personal experience, that it's very important to have a teacher, to have someone to check what you're experiencing. Because, I mean, illusions never stop. And especially there, illusions are very deeply rooted.
Yes, 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 I agree. I mean, again, I think of it as a foundational training program. And whenever you need it, you'll graduate. You know, whenever you need to graduate, you'll graduate. But this is like an undergraduate degree. You know? And actually, we are actually, funnily enough, we're just starting to have a thing where you can book a check-in with somebody. So you know, that'll be something that I think is going to help. And there's a lot of Q&A. We get tons of questions, and
of course.
Record tons of answers.
So. I mean, the next step, if I'm honest and think a bit towards the future, the next step is, and I think there are already people working on that, to introduce AI.
Yeah, I know.
And I know that from, you know, studies in therapy. It works amazingly well. A lot of therapists are really pissed about that because they, you know, that's their way of dealing with it. And, you know, AI is doing something similar, at least at a certain stage.
Yes.
Maybe not with severe psychological problems. But when you talk about just, you know, your regular Q&A thing, a lot of questions, of course, repeat themselves. So it makes sense to work with AI in the end.
You know, we haven't yet made that decision. And I mean, we've decided against that up to now. You know, I think our engineers use AI for their coding.
Of course they do. Everyone does now.
But in terms of actual content, we haven't yet gone there, because I mean, our idea is that there's something valuable in knowing as a human being. But maybe we'll realize in 5 years, no, or sooner, that no, we should try it
anyway, whether AI or not. I think it's so important to have a good teacher. That's at least my experience. And to be honest, there are a lot of people running around, you know, trying to give the impression that there are some sort of guru or Zen teacher or, you know, some other kind of teacher. And they really aren't.
Yeah, I know. I mean, to add another loop on this, I mean, I thought, well, actually, you know, granted all the limitations of it being a sort of one-way street, you know, it's not interactive for the moment, this is some way of getting a kind of training.
Of course.
You know,
yeah, I agree.
You know, and so I really, when I was in the book and in the app, I was sort of like, well, the things that I used to be asked in Docusan one by one, individually, this is what they boil down to.
Yeah.
So this is, of course, it's not the same as one to one, but I still think this would be a really good place for somebody to start.
You know? My feeling is, I was at a meeting of, you know, some Zen teachers and some scientists. And one of the things we talked, it was about really the evolution of Zen. And one of the things we talked about was koan training. And I was really amazed that a lot of the male and female Zen teachers in America obviously sort of withdraw a bit from koan training because there was misconduct on the one on one hand, you know, a too intense relationship. Yeah. Then there was the problem: how do you avoid that? And then maybe it's too Japanese in the end anyway. And to be honest, I don't know what to think about it. But my experience is that koan training is really a great thing, and maybe it has to be done person to person with a teacher, maybe one day person to AI, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, koan training was a life changer for me. It was absolutely the best training I could have had. But I would say that of all the people that I would see coming to the Zendo, mm-hmm. it was some small percentage for whom it was exactly the right thing. You know, 10 mm-hmm. to 20% or something.
That's not much. That's not much.
I think for many more people, you know, it's an intense training. It's an intense and an intensive training. Yeah. And I think it's really a teacher training, actually. I do, really, you know.
That's exactly what happens when people run, that's my impression, when they run through all the, you know, various collections of koans. In the end, they want to become Zen teachers. What if you don't want to become a Zen teacher?
Exactly. I think we need a broader teaching process that's just great for everybody. And that's really what I've been trying to develop, I think, is mm-hmm. a more universal approach to meditation that totally acknowledges, you know, the wonder of non-dual experience and actually more than one path to it, but among those paths, koan training is perhaps in a certain, I mean, I think it's one of the best because it takes you beyond experience into living it.
Yes. We talked, you know, when I said, don't stop the book here, there is an epilogue. Yeah. Inculturation or incorporation of that experience of awakening into ordinary life.
Exactly.
And I felt that koans are very helpful in doing that.
Yes, I think that's their primary aim. Because, by the way, for people who don't know, you know, in a traditional koan training, one-on-one with a teacher, in this, the way certainly it's done in Sambo Zen, you don't just sort of talk about a koan. You have to present or embody each koan.
Exactly.
And when you do that 500 times, you know, it sort of gets into the fabric of your being in a new way. And that's its great value. It's like, because everybody who's had a glimpse of the non-dual, the question then is, well, I've got to live this. This is reality. I must live it. How right. do I do that? And it's not so easy because we're so conditioned to seeing things the way we have done.
And there's always the fast way, and you talked about that in your book too, which is psychedelica. You might know that in Zurich, there was this scientific experiment with a group of Zen, Felsentor. Yes. You might know them.
I've read about it. Yeah, I've read
with
the article.
Psilocybin. And it was a tremendous, in a way, it was a tremendous success because it helped people to get over a certain threshold which they never crossed. Yes. So, you know, when people hear that, they think, well, I don't need an app. I just take the right drug. That's even faster.
Yes. But if you look at all the wise researchers into psychedelics like Roland Griffiths and I can't remember all their names, they're meditators,
of course,
because it's not enough to have a psychedelic experience. It's how do I embody this? By the way, my view with psychedelics is that people don't just go to the fourth in, they go to all four ins. Often they'll have a beautiful experience of mindfulness that they never had before, or they'll have a beautiful experience of blessed support coming from outside that they never had before, or they get into flow states in a no effort, no self, it's beautiful, but it's not awakening. You know, sometimes when the reports that I've heard of people, sometimes yes, it might be a non-dual experience. But even then, I mean, I'm thinking of one guy who did, you know, the 5-MeO DMT, that very strong one. And he had, you know, when he showed me his sort of report on the experience, it was like, wow, this is a pretty clear Kensho. You know, and then we started talking and it hadn't changed him. Because he just knew there was something in my bloodstream. It's no longer in my bloodstream.
So it's gone.
It's gone.
It's not a truth, as you said.
Exactly. It wasn't, I've had this incredible insight into the nature of my own being. You know, which is, I mean, look, I think psychedelics have tremendous benefit therapeutically, and it's a wonderful thing that they're in the arsenal of psychotherapy now, and they could have a lot of help on this more esoteric stuff that we've been talking about. I think if somebody combines occasional psychedelic usage with a meditative path, maybe it's good, maybe it's better than no psychedelics. But I think without the meditation, it's not going to be life, it's less likely to be life-changing.
Have you talked about your four ins and what you're doing now with the Japanese Zambo Kyodan community?
Well, I talk about it with my own master, Rion Roshi, who's the abbot of Sambo Zen. He's not that interested.
You know? Interesting.
Because it's, you know, from their point of view, it's a Zen light, you know, it is really compared to the deep training that you're familiar with. And I used to do a lot of, you know, it's not as rigorous. It's not as deep. It's more introductory. It's more foundational. It's somewhat educational, I think, you know, and I think that actually it's no surprise that way more people are doing our app than are doing, you know, that more traditional training, of course, because...
Do they mind? No.
I don't think so. I mean, maybe one or two might, I don't know. You know, they might not tell me. I don't know. But I think on the whole, no, because actually, you know, tons of people have been going to Sambo Zen centers as a result. Say, I want a deeper practice. I've been exposed to, I know about this now from doing Henry's app or reading Henry's book. And, you know, it's become a little bit of a channel for people to find their way to Sambo Zen.
Yeah, you know, so the app and your book are a very good foundation to if you want to continue the Zen way or maybe another way and deepen that experience in that form.
Exactly. You know, and I think, you know, we're living in a time when we just have to be more pluralistic about meditation.
Exactly. Yeah. Most of these ways are always monistic.
They are. Still. I mean, you can understand it because they grew up often in rural isolation. So they had strange ideas about what other Buddhists were doing and other traditions were doing. Yeah. But, you know, now everybody's meeting everybody, and you know, and everybody's meeting science as well. So, I think it's a spectacularly positive thing to be able to. I mean, when I had that experience when I was 19 years old, I had nowhere to turn. I didn't even think that there might be somewhere to turn. I started going to churches actually in my early 20s. It was a wasteland in terms of what I'd experienced. Nobody was talking about anything that resonated at all with what I'd experienced.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah,
you know,
similar with me. Yeah,
you know, and so now, I mean, I'm really, if you know, in part, I've done all this for that guy, that 19-year-old, and because there'll be more of us.
Yeah,
there'll be, you know, and you know, and whatever age somebody stumbles into some of this, I'd love them to have a framework for understanding it and realizing that there's support and guidance available if you want it, you know.
And better for them to have a good app. I have a last question. Is there a question about your own practice that no interviewer has asked you and you wish someone would have asked you already?
Oh, gosh, I love that question. Let me just
think. That's a bad one, I know.
Yeah, no, I think there must be. And it's something around, like, I'm not quite sure what the question is that would give me this, that would make me give this answer, but I'm going to try to give the answer that I would give. It's something about, I almost would say in my own practice, I'm not interested in awakening anymore.
Great.
And I'm really happy about that. And it doesn't feel like I couldn't exactly, you know, maybe my practice has gone backwards, but if it has, I don't mind at all.
You know? Well, no, that's the 10 Oxfording pictures at the end. You're just a regular guy with lots of other people, you know, talking,
that
doing
would be
weird
a, that's
stuff.
A very, that's a charitable interpretation. It's very kind of you. I wish that might be true, but I don't really know. But I know that, oh gosh, I'm just so grateful to, you know, to be alive and to have this practice.
Yeah.
You know.
Henry, thank you so much. And, you know, not just for the book, but for sharing what you think about the book and the practice and the way. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for this time together and for inviting me to reflect on all this. It's really a great honor and joy.
Thanks.
Skobel von und mit Gerd Skobel. Produziert von der Pro Bono Fernsehproduktion GmbH. Postproduktion René Fischel. Musik Pascal Hadré. Sprecherin Kim Plettemeier. Finanziert wird dieser Kanal von 3 gemeinnützigen Organisationen: der Udo Keller Stiftung Forum Humanum und der Okeanos Stiftung für das Meer, sowie vom AVE-Institut für Achtsamkeit, Verbundenheit, Engagement.